Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours. In store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon, and you're very welcome to Liveline. And 51551 is our text number, and joe at rte.ie. On the 25th of February last, Anne Delaney, age 47, died on the streets of Dublin, in Anger Street in Dublin there, on near St. Stephen's Green. Her death, as you know, sparked an awful lot of media interest and social commentary on social media. The family of Anne Delaney have contacted us, and one in particular, her brother, and we presume he's speaking on behalf of the family, he's asked us to convey the following. They're still deeply distraught, and if anyone had seen the funeral of dear Anne a few days later, would have realised the upset of the family, her mother and the remainder of the family and many others, on the passing of this young woman. This is what they want to say. Anne Delaney was a daughter, a sister and a mother. My family did everything in our power to help her. She was never homeless. As a family, our door was always open to her. While I don't have to justify what my family did and how much we tried to help her, we've been left hurt by the uninformed and nasty comments online. In addition to grieving the loss of a family member, I have to deal with these painful comments which faceless people hiding behind keyboards leave on various social media sites and comment sections. Hurtful comments do not wash over me. The disgusting comments leave me angry. I want to acknowledge the outpouring of grief at the vigil in Dublin City and the overwhelming support we received from our local community. We will never forget what our neighbours and friends did to help us. We are good people who did not turn our backs on our sister. And I would also ask people not to hijack Anne's story for their own purposes. As I said already, she was a daughter, sister and mother, and not to be used as a rallying call. And I go back to the second line they use, because I saw a lot of the social media and other comment about Anne immediately after she passed. And a lot of commentary, by the way, was people who knew her. She was in a particular spot on Angel Street, and they were very kind to her and were very fond of her. But the family want to say she was never homeless. As a family, our door was always open to her. We are good people. We did not turn our backs on our sister. We would ask people not to hijack Anne's story for their own purposes. As I said, and this is the brother, as I said already, she was a daughter, sister and mother. And we ask that she not be used as a rallying call. OK. Joe, it's important that we read that out on behalf of the brother in particular. Obviously, he's been talking to his family, and it's self-explanatory. Joe with RT.ie. Bernadette, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, how are you?
Good, and you're on WhatsApp. So, Bernadette, you contacted us because you want to raise awareness of OCD, Obsessive Compulsion Disorder. Go ahead, Bernadette.
Yeah, that's correct. So, OCD, I'd have it myself for many years, but I do find it's something a lot of people think, like, oh, it's just the cleaning, you're cleaning at home, that's great, or you get those comments, oh, I'd love you to clean my house. But it's really not like that. It's a very distressing and debilitating illness, which can cause like a lot of anxiety and stuff.
And you, in your case, is it the obsessive cleaning, the washing, the hygiene? Is that very important to you in your OCD? It's very prominent.
Yeah, in my case, so I flare and go up and down. But at the moment, I will be quite flare the last 2 months. So I'm talking, I could have 7 showers. Some days I'd use 2 bottles of shampoos. I could put on a wash cycle, and I could have the same washing repeatedly for 2 cycles, 4, 6. It literally, there's no number. It's when it clicks okay in your head.
Yeah.
As well as, you know, your normal daily cleaning.
Yeah.
Well, my normal For other people, that's easier and relaxing to do. For me, my normal daily cleaning could be done twice or three times a day, and your monthly cleaning would be done for me twice a week. It's really distressing because I actually don't want to do it. There's times I'm cleaning and I'm actually crying, but I can't stop doing it.
So from,
it's a massive thing. Okay. Yeah.
So from the moment you get up, Bernadette, in the morning, is that the first thing you think of? How I have to stay absolutely and obsessively clean and everything around me?
Yeah, it's my house is, I suppose, my safety habitat. So when I go outside, which I find quite difficult to do at the moment, even like to do the groceries or things like that, I'm outside and you present normal, I'm fine and you're okay on the outside world. But if someone bumps into you, all I'm thinking is I need to go home and double wash this coat, my shoes and socks outside. Like, I cannot come back into my house without going straight up the stairs and into the shower. Even if I go two steps outside my house to the car, I physically can't come back in through the house without showering.
And what about
now? A lot of
Would you handshake?
No, I find it difficult, and there has been situations where I'd be uncomfortable, I suppose, if you were meeting new people and stuff in the past, then you would. But then I'd be going home to scrub the life out of my hands. I sanitize. Like, there's been times my hands would bleed because I haven't cleaned so much.
Public,
it's quite difficult.
Public transport?
No, I cannot use it whatsoever. It drives me like insane. It's just, I don't know who's been sat there, who's been on it. It's something I really, really struggle with. Even the likes of taxis or things like that, I couldn't get in them. No, not at all.
And if you if you went to a local cafe and you were walking in or out and you brushed, as we all do, you brush off somebody.
Yeah, that's the hard part. So when you're not flared, it's okay, as in you're not as distressed, but I'll still wash my clothes and stuff. But when somebody does it, I'm always like, I need to go home and double wash, and that they don't realise. You might see a familiar face and they like touch your arm and like, well, how are you? But really, it's actually causing a lot of anxiety inside. And because it's so hidden on the outside, it's a hidden illness, because they don't see that it's actually killing them on the inside. Like, I'm coming home, getting out of my car, taking my shoes and socks off outside my front door, running up my stairs into the shower. And sometimes I have to get out of the shower, bring my washing down that I knew they touched, put it in the washing machine, clean all the floors that I was on, and get back in the shower.
And as you say, even when you put your wash on, you'll do see, it's not one click. It's not one cycle of an hour and 20 minutes or whatever. You could go through six or seven cycles. Seven washes of the same clothing.
That's it. And sometimes it's crazy because I could put one in and it would click on one and it's the best feeling. But sometimes, like, I have a couple of towels in there now and they're on, well, they're actually got on their fifth wash or on their fourth. It's just until it clicks in my head. But there is times I have washing done, they're on the clothes or far away, and I could go into the room and I think I get like a strange smell or feeling, and I will pull them out and I'll rewash them. It's a constant cycle. Like I'll give you an example. My bills, let's say a month before December were 120.
Okay.
And from January, I pay monthly, so from January and February, I'm talking for washing machine and showers. From January and February, they went up to 240 and 280 each month.
They doubled, yeah.
Like, literally doubled, because the showers and washing is extreme.
And Bernadette, do you work outside the home?
Walk or work?
Do you work? Sorry, work, my fault. Do you work?
I did.
Yeah, and how do you manage that?
I actually don't anymore. I was in a call centre in Infosys and I transferred to home, but I'm actually signed off. I'm just mentally not in a place to be in work right now.
Okay.
So I'm signed off on that. Yeah.
And have you a diagnosis from your GP for your sick cert?
I do. And I have a clinical diagnosis of OCD.
Mm-hmm.
So it's obsessive compulsive disorder. So basically, I suppose a lot of people don't understand that it just can look like intrusive thoughts or cleaning disorders. So it's basically one gets an obsessive thought, like we all do. But in someone's, I suppose, I don't want to say normal brain, but let's perhaps say in your brain, I'm not sure what way yours is, the okay. thought would come in and it would go out without a second or thought. With OCD, it gets stuck in a loophole and you get anxiety. And then you have to do your compulsion and you get temporary relief. And then you're stuck in that cycle. Thought, anxiety, compulsion, relief.
You've an incredible understanding of it, Bernadette. And I think that's very helpful for people. Have you any idea how and when and why it started?
For me personally, I have a couple of ideas when I got it. I don't know why. They say it can be genetic. They say it can be traumas. They can't tell someone you have this because of this. They actually can't do that because they don't know. Yeah, it's quite a difficult one. But I have it since I'm about 13 or 14, but I was never really bad. See, my mum and dad tried to bring me to CBT in Dungarvan.
Cognitive behaviour therapy, to try and deal with the OCD.
I hated it.
Okay.
Yeah, so that would be exposure. So basically, they'd be like, go home and literally don't wash your hands after flushing the toilet or rub that material you don't like. And I was too young and I just hated it because it caused me a lot of stress. A lot. Now, there's other therapies as well. There's psychology, which she does eye rapid movements. They show you some techniques with that. She also does a talk therapy. So basically, you're talking to yourself. This sounds mad because when she first done it with me, I was like, I feel like I'm crazy. But you're in a chair, and you're visualizing talking to yourself. Then you're moving yourself to the other position of the room. You're kind of questioning why you get those thoughts and how do they make you feel and telling your OCD like you don't like it and stuff like that. But I actually, I went to psychology, but I was so extreme. She actually recommended me going on meds so I could go back and do the therapy because I couldn't actually do the therapy because my OCD was so bad.
And has your OCD intensified?
Yes, it's intensified. I'd say it was slowly coming down the last 6 months. I could see it coming, but come January, it just kind of hit me like a ton of bricks coming into January. And I can't leave, like, my family, no one. It's just my son and my partner can come into my house. Like, my mom, my dad, my sister, brother, they can't come into my house, like, ever.
Why not?
I just can't have people in here. I don't know where they... And they take off their shoes and stuff, but I just can't.
And why did you think, Bernadette, it was going to come at you with such force in the recent past?
In the recent past, I think OCD is triggered by a lot of stress. And I suppose I've had a lot of stress going on in the background, which I would have managed well in the past and I thought I managed well with it now. But I suppose, basically, as you know yourself, because we discussed, I had a case in the summer. In 2019, I was assaulted. I was raped and the man in question is in prison serving 7.5 years, but he's since appealed it, so he can't be named.
Okay.
So I thought that was on in the summer. And then it was postponed till November, just gone, 2023.
Okay.
So that was stressful. And come November, he got the sentence and I thought, okay, can kind of start to relax again.
Yeah.
So I'm not blaming it all on this, but it's a trigger.
Yeah.
Start to relax again. And then at some point in January, I got notified he's appealed it. And I suppose OCD is something you deal when you actually have loss of control on your outside life, when you can't control it.
Yeah.
Even though you can't control your OCD, you can control your temporary relief feeling, what you get from it.
And was there, did you, for the court case, did you were you assessed by a psychiatrist about the impact on you, the victim?
Yes, I actually have a psychiatry team myself, so I was, and I had a letter went into court saying it significantly impacted my mental health.
Okay.
as part of my victim impact that did go in from my psychiatry team.
Yeah. And your even that analysis there you offered in one sentence, that is, with your OCD, you are in total control. Now, another control, as you say, is obviously compulsive. You have your showers nonstop. You clean yourself. You wash yourself. You wash your clothes. You wash the floor. Anywhere, you're really conscious of not coming in contact with other people apart from your partner and your son. So that gives you this incredible control. But outside your life, you felt, obviously, if you have been... which you were raped, which is such a violent attack where you have no control. Do your psychiatry team, would they link one to the other?
So from that incident, so as we know, I'm diagnosed with OCD. From that incident in 2019, I was diagnosed with PTSD.
Okay.
So common with that. Look, we know I've had OCD before, and I'm not saying this happened and it gave me OCD. Definitely
fair,
not.
Yeah.
I'm not going to paint out one thing. It's not who I am, but it definitely, the stress of it and everything, the unknowing, definitely didn't help my OCD, if I put it that way.
Okay, of course not. And you say the reason you contacted, you want to raise awareness of OCD. What would you be saying to people who don't understand it, or as you say, what was your earlier remarks right at the start? They just think you're odd because you wash yourself all the time. What do you think? What would you like to say to people to try and get a better understanding of OCD?
Yeah, I find, because when you're explaining it to some people, sometimes they think, like, they go, "Oh my God, that's terrible," or "Jesus, will you come down and clean my house?"
I've heard
that. You kind of laugh it off because, like, they don't know. But the reality is I'm at home crying cleaning my house that I already cleaned 2 times today. It's just something I think it's not very spoken about, and perhaps because of the stigma around it, I think people with OCD should probably talk about it more, because not one fits all. These are my experiences. There's other people, like, you can get intrusive thoughts. I do get them as well, but I didn't really touch into that. But I shake door handles, I clean, I wash, I do. Typical what you'd get a diagnosis on OCD. But it can affect people in many different ways for other things that mightn't be anyway linked to mine. So I think a lot of people need to talk about it, raise more awareness on it, be open. I think some people think there's actually something wrong with them, because I feel like that myself at times, and they don't want to. They think, no, this is normal. I'm just cleaning and I can't stop and that. But when it comes to something where you're just stressed, that you're crying because you don't want to clean, it's not normal. That's when you kind of need to seek the help or advice.
Brenda, you also said that, you know, you've been experiencing gradations of OCD since your teens. Is there any treatment or therapy or relationship with professionals? Mm-hmm. Is there anything that helped, that diluted the OCD in the last 10 years or whatever?
Yeah, so when I was a teen, it was quite gentle OCD. I wouldn't have seen. I was very distressed, I suppose. Well, I would have been distressed, but not very distressed, quite gentle. So up until I was about, we'll say 18, gentle OCD. And then coming up into my 20s, I got worse again. And I actually got put on medication, which, unfortunately for me, medication, it was the one that worked for me. I don't like medication for OCD. It's very hit and miss. Sometimes you can get one and it mightn't work, and you need to try a few different ones, so it's hard to judge. But for me, it's the medication that's helping me right now. Psychology does help. Unfortunately, you have to be in a place where your OCD isn't so heightened that you can actually go there and do the exposure therapy without being so distraught.
And I could relate. I mean, I think anyone would relate to that point you made earlier, Bernadette, about CBT, and that you were told, well, go home and use the loo and don't wash your hands. I'm sure to most people that would be repugnant anyway.
Exactly. And it just doesn't sound normal, but basically they're trying to retrain your brain. There is a clinic in Dublin. I've been looking into it. I haven't went, but I think it's called TMS. I could be corrected now, but it's basically they put these things on your head and they send these little currents into your mind. It's basically to try, I suppose, repair a damaged area, because OCD sometimes in the brain can show up as little damaged areas.
Okay.
So there is that I'm just having a look into, and there's a surgery, but that's in America. So I suppose we're a little bit behind on it in that sense, but definitely something I know.
Is there any book you've read or any program you watched that clicked with you in terms of, hang on, that sounds familiar? Is there anything you've come across so far in literature or in therapy or training or organisation that have clicked with you?
There was one, I'm trying to think, it was on TV a while ago, I think it was called OCD and Me. And I remember watching it. There was three people doing a study on it. I'm trying to find it now on Google. And I just remember going, oh my God, this is the perfect, this is what they need to be putting out there for people to get it. I need to try find this. And if I can't, I'm going to text it in to you because I need you to watch it later. It's just, it really does explain.
Say with us, Brendan. I really appreciate your contact. Declan O'Connor, 51551 Joe at rt.ie, 0818 715 815. Declan, good afternoon.
Hi, Joe. How you doing?
Your opening phrase, I see there. I presume I'm 36 and I suffer from OCD. When did OCD enter your life, Declan?
I'd say likewise for that, around probably the start of teenage, around 12, 13.
Okay.
Started, I suppose, with the cleanliness and the order traits, you know, trying to kind of have things, the need to have things in specific order, needing to kind of have things clean. And I suppose the intrusive thoughts that kind of come with this is that, like, if you don't have these things in order, if you don't have these things clean, something bad will happen.
Okay.
That's how it tends to manifest itself.
And is it still persisting? You're 36 now.
No, I'm 36 now. So, I mean, you're talking over 20 years ago now. Over the years, I suppose, there have been some, you know, rough flare-ups where, I suppose, it may have jumped from cleanliness and order, and then it could go to, you know, needing things just right, feeling responsible for others, feeling responsible for, like, events in the world that have absolutely nothing to do with you. But, like, OCD, it's illogical. Like, it doesn't make sense to, what do you call it, to, like those who have OCD, we know it's illogical. We know the thoughts that come into our head aren't rational, that they don't make sense, but it's the anxiety that the thoughts create that create the compulsions to do something about them. Whether that's something in our brain, the chemistry isn't working properly, etc. But I suppose I was kind of speaking to your research there beforehand as well, that, like, OCD is ego dystonic, which means that, like, the thoughts that OCD creates, they go completely against someone's character and someone's values.
Okay.
So, for example, like, I suppose you could get thoughts where, say, you're a bad person, you know, and then you feel like you need to do something in order to kind of prove to yourself you're not a bad person, whereas the truth is, you're a very good person. You're very well natured, but again, it's the thoughts that try and kind of come into your head and create anxiety, trying to convince you literally that you're not a bad person or that you are a bad person, you know.
And how you say you're doing well now, Declan? So, what made a difference?
Therapy, definitely. I suppose, when do you call it? So, started 12, 13. Then there was a few years of kind of, call it calm if you want, but I suppose I didn't know what it was at that stage. It wasn't until I was early 20s, mid-20s, that I got an official diagnosis of having OCD.
Okay.
And I suppose between those 10, 12 years, like, there was one or two flare-ups, and then I got diagnosed, and then I had a few good years, and then I had a rough flare-up at the end of my 20s. And then since then, I was working one-on-one with an OCD specialist based here in Ireland, and it was cognitive behavioural therapy as well, and I suppose a very specific kind. It's called ERP, it's Exposure and Response Prevention.
Okay.
So the idea of this therapy is along with your therapist, to expose you to the intrusive thoughts, you know, the things that make you anxious, the things that you know are irrational, and then expose you to it and allow the anxiety to go up. And then the response prevention is to not do the compulsion. For example, if you get an intrusive thought, and for example, Bernadette speaking before, the feeling that she needs to shower, she needs to wash her hands, etc. I suppose in a CBT and ERP sense, it would be getting your hands dirty, and then that would be the exposure, and then the response prevention would be not washing your hands after that, allowing the anxiety to go up, and then teaching your brain that nothing bad is going to happen.
Okay.
You know, doesn't work overnight, absolutely not. It is hard work, but it's absolutely, it's so valuable. Like, it's so, so useful in terms of, I won't say recover from OCD, because I still, like, OCD is still there for me.
You still have flare-ups.
I wouldn't even call them flare-ups. Like, I still do get intrusive thoughts, but because I've just become desensitized to them, basically, they don't have the same effect that they once would have had.
And Bernadette Declan, as you said, he's now in his mid to late 30s. What age group are you, Bernadette, can I ask?
I'm 30.
30, okay. But Declan, you're saying there is hope.
Oh, God, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
100%. There is hope, and there's like so many resources out there. The International OCD Foundation has so many resources. IOCDF.com. So many books out there as well. And OCD, like, it's something that maybe 20 years ago wasn't fully understood, but it is an anxiety disorder that is absolutely treatable. With medication in some cases, without in other cases, you know, everyone is different. I take medication for it, and it's been fantastic for me. Some people choose not to take medication, and that's their choice, and they do very well with that also. So,
okay. Bernadette, the thing I sense is, well, you're not without hope in terms of...
No. And when he said, like, he's gone through years where it's kind of, I suppose, okay and flaring up and down, it regulates so much, because that's the thing. Sometimes you can be so good and then it can blip, but you can be so good again.
Mm-hmm.
But actually, when you went to him, I got a bit excited, because I was like, there's someone on the line with OCD, because I've only ever spoke to one other person who has it. So I got a bit excited. Yeah. And the ERP, yes, it's meant to be amazing. That's the
explain ERP to me.
The exposure upon exposure.
Okay.
Unfortunately, because I'm so heightened at the moment, that's where the psychology advised I go on meds until I can expose myself to it. But it is meant to be good. But look, I know there's a lot of work I need to put in here, but it's something I definitely think needs to be more open. An open book for people to talk about, I suppose.
Okay. But Declan, did you mention a group as well there that Bernadette could get in touch with?
Well, I suppose there's different groups on Facebook. There's OCD support groups on Facebook. There is the International OCD Foundation as well. They're based in America. Lots of really good resources. There's groups online. There's CBT groups online that I suppose COVID did one good thing, and it gave us kind of Zoom, etc. So, I mean, you'd be able to link in with kind of therapists who specialize in OCD treatments based in America. But again, like, they're, you know, top of the class when it comes to treatment. So there's a person I follow on Facebook as well. His name is Shannon Shai, and he has done so much work in the area of OCD. He had OCD himself, and he has recovered from OCD, and he was at the bottom of the barrel, he says himself, and, you know, got himself out of it. And yeah, I think the main thing you're saying is there absolutely is hope. It takes work, it takes hard work, absolutely, but there is hope, definitely, of course.
Okay. Bernadette, you've definitely started a conversation. Will you seem open, Brenda, to trying other things, to try and, when you describe, you describe it so succinctly and very clearly, especially to those who don't suffer from OCD. Are you hopeful, Bernadette?
I'm definitely hopeful, because as I said, I had it from a young age, but it wasn't bad. I did have many months and times where I felt free and not compelled, and it's unfortunate that I've slipped, I suppose, in my mind, and I'm back to where I don't want to be. I know, I suppose, from having my experience in the past, I know I can get there again, but it's just extremely difficult. Like the gentleman said, I can't remember his name.
Declan,
my apologies. There is a lot of work that does need to be put into it and have the mindset and go into that. But yeah, and I really appreciate you like coming on here and talking about this, because it's something that's really important to me.
Well, I really appreciate you contacting us and coming on air. Bernadette, thanks indeed. Declan, yes, please do.
Just very quickly, where she's saying it does take hard work, but it's, she said right there, it is her mindset. That is absolutely it. And there will be slips. Absolutely. Mm. It's not going to happen overnight. Like, it is, you're literally kind of retraining your brain to understand that these intrusive thoughts don't have the weight that they're trying to convince you that they do. And I mean, it is a journey, absolutely. And there will be slip ups, 100%. That's okay. Like, you know, we don't have to be perfect at recovering from it. Like, it's going to be two good days, one bad day, you know. But definitely kind of look at the resources online. The IOCD in America are fantastic. Shannon Shai, I would definitely recommend looking up his three books out. Okay. He's fantastic.
But Declan, even a point you made earlier, and I'm addressing this to Brendan as well, where you said when you were in a situation where OCD was very prevalent in your life, you were blaming yourself for things which you had absolutely no control over. You were hard on yourself.
Oh, God, yeah. Those with OCD are perfectionists.
Okay.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you have perfectionists in life, and then you have OCD with perfectionists. Okay. yeah, like, literally, you would blame yourself for things that have absolutely nothing to do with you. And again, what do you call it? That's the way the OCD works. Like, it doesn't make sense. The thoughts that come into your head, they're irrational. They don't make sense. And you know that they don't make sense. But it's because of the anxiety that they create, you feel that you need to act on it in order to get rid of this anxiety. Where in truth is, if you let the anxiety be there and pass, it will go and you will be fine. But of course, it's almost like taking that risk, if you get me.
Okay. Bernadette, thanks indeed. And Declan, thanks indeed. Thank you both for sharing. Thank you both. Joe at rt.ie, 51551 is the text.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Well, last week we heard from a mother whose daughter was homeless and in a very difficult situation. And she was making the same point, indeed, that the family of Anne Delaney have made on the programme today, that Anne was a daughter, a sister and a mother. The family did everything in their power to help her. She was never homeless, as our family door, our family homes were always open to her. And this is another letter we've just got in from another mother, and you can hear the situation she ended up in with her daughter.
Joe, I heard the letter you read out in the show last week about the mother's fears for her daughter living on the streets of Dublin. It stopped myself and my husband in our tracks, staring over at each other, shocked. We couldn't believe it. We thought someone had written to you about our daughter. We even contacted some of our family and friends to see if they had and if they'd written a letter and sent it to you. They hadn't. It wasn't about our daughter, but it could have been. She had a severe breakdown many years ago, and despite her trying to get her help many, many times, including many appointments in many hospitals and clinics, she walked or signed herself out of their care. She's also able to present very well, and when we tried to intervene, we could not convince her or those in charge to get her the help she so desperately needed. We haven't seen her in a year, and we're broken. She was looking for money from us after she lost her job, and we were told by giving her money we were enabling her, but she threatened us if we didn't. She even threatened to beg from our neighbours and the locals in our village when we didn't give her the money she demanded. Eventually, she left home because we stopped giving her money. One time we tried to do an intervention, but she snuck out of the house and disappeared. We know she's living on the streets of Dublin. We just don't know where. We phone her, text her, and she may reply eventually, but not always. It's so stressful and worrying. We're now elderly and we should be at the stage of our lives when we're looking forward to our time with our grandchildren, but we're exhausted when the time comes. The Gardaí came to our door looking for her, but we just told them the truth. We don't know where she is, and that is awful. My husband had a dinner in Dublin town, and instead of enjoying it, he spent his time walking and looking in every doorway and alley he passed to see if his daughter was there. We regularly go into Dublin to look for her, but we haven't found her, and it's heartbreaking as well to see how many people are living on the streets. Our daughter desperately needs to be sectioned for her own safety. We need intervention, but nobody seems to care. We're helpless and worn down. We're pensioners now, grandparents, our hearts are broken. We've sleepless nights, our lives are turned upside down. It's such a worry. And at the heart of it all, she's my child, my baby. She's troubled and in need of help. The thought of her in the streets is so painful. I can't believe this is happening. It's every parent's worst nightmare. We need help. Please, help us help her.
Okay, that letter speaks for itself. And Catherine, good afternoon, Catherine.
Hi, Joe, how are you?
Good. I'm going back to the letter from the family and the representative of Anne Delaney's family. One thing they do say, in addition to grieving the loss of our family member Anne Delaney, who died on Angel Street in Dublin at the end of February, we have to deal with these painful comments which faces people hiding behind keyboards leave on various social media sites and comment sections. And those comments are something that upsets you greatly because you it is about being a foster parent. And the recent controversy, which the shocking controversy about the cost for emergency accommodation for young people who are in trouble. In one case, it was €1,200 per night for two rooms in a hotel for one teenager who was going through difficulties. The teenager had one room, and then in an adjoining room, there was two members of staff. €1,200 a night. And that brought up the whole issue of why aren't there more foster parents. But you were upset by some of the commentary online subsequently about foster parents.
Yeah, yeah. First of all, can I first of all express my sincere condolences to Anne Delaney's family.
Yeah, yes.
And I just want to say as well, I'm not piggybacking on her tragic story.
Of course, you
contacted
us completely separately. Yes, absolutely.
No, but I had emails independently and
yeah,
it just happened.
Of course, of course.
They both kind of overlapped. So I suppose over the last... It happens a lot. It's not just over the past few weeks, but over the past few weeks, because TUSA and the care system has been in the headlines, I have noticed an increase in the hate, vile comments that are being made about the care system. Now, it is, in general, about the wider care system, but these are people that are not care aware, you know, and they don't understand what it means to be care aware, you know, and these vile, horrible comments about, you know, children being kidnapped and it's not true. They're just ridiculous comments. And as a foster care, I take in these children that TUSLA have to take for whatever reason.
Yes.
And, you know, some of that, hearing that story and story, you know, I can honestly say that I've never met a mother that didn't love her children. Ever. And I've been a foster care for 15 years and I've had a number of children in my care, and every single one of those mothers loved their children. They couldn't take care of them for whatever reason, but they loved them. And, you know, to think that, for instance, a child coming into care and their mother going online and looking at those comments and thinking that that's what's happening to their children, when in fact it's the exact opposite. You know, foster carers in this country, any foster care I know, and I know from my own, and I'm only going to speak from my own point of view.
Yes, yes.
We have absolutely loved the children.
Yeah.
And some of them have gone home, and that's been hard. It's been hard to hand them back, but that's where they need to be. They need to be at home. You know, some of them have moved on. It's heartbreaking to see that some people can vilify, like, I'm not a villain for taking in someone else's child when they need me. But we're being vilified online, and it's really, really hard. You know, we carry an awful lot of emotional baggage as foster carers. You know, we carry the emotional baggage of the children in our care. We carry the emotional baggage of the families. Like, I'm totally empathetic to the families of the children that I have in my care. I have to be. You know, I can't parent those children if I don't, you know, understand where their families are coming from or where they're coming from in the situation they're coming from.
But I one of the angles, and it was also that powerful story in the Irish Times over the last 2 weeks, led by Jack Power, about these agencies, one agency in particular, set up that people weren't vetted, documents were duplicated when they shouldn't have been duplicated. And one of the arguments then was to say, well, we don't have enough foster parents. Now, surely that would reflect, that would encourage people to become a foster parent. But you say when you see this, like, foster parents are paid. But as we've known from this programme, especially in the last 18 months, there was a major campaign by foster parents. I think it was over 2 weeks on this programme, highlighting the minuscule amount of money that they actually get to take in children who are in severe difficulties. And then when you hear a figure over the last few weeks that the Tusla were paying €1,200 per night for two hotel rooms, one for the teenager or whatever, the adolescent, and an adjoining room, obviously with a door, for two members of staff who would be there 24/7 with the adolescent. And that $1,200, I suspect, I cannot imagine how long. I think foster parents get about €2 an hour. I cannot imagine how long it would take for a foster parent to make is the wrong word, to generate €1,200 in payments from Tusla. It would take an awful long time, an awful long time. So why aren't there more people fostering? Is it because they're afraid of this backlash, or you're being paid? Even though most of the keyboard warriors obviously don't know the minuscule amount foster parents are being paid pro rata.
Yeah, well, I guess the first thing that I have to say, and it's a big thing within the fostering community, is foster carers are not paid. Foster carers get an allowance.
Yeah,
they get an allowance for the children. And, I mean, I'd love to go through, and I could spend hours, but I'd love to go through the stages of when a child comes to you and has nothing, you know. And you can't just buy a child one pair of shoes, you know. You can't,
if
they need shoes, two, three pairs of shoes, wellies, coats, winter coats, clothes, you know, you have education. People seem to think, and they do, I know for a fact that people think that foster carers, they get extra, they get money towards going to school, they get money. We don't. It's at the moment, it's €350 a week.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to get into the whole money side of it, but it's €350 a week. It went up €25 in January. We were awarded €75 extra child, but we had to wait until November for the apparently.
But then it hadn't gone up, as foster parents told us, in over 10 or 12 years.
Yeah.
Incredible,
yeah.
incredible. Yeah. Now, Catherine, and you're right to say it's not pay, it's an allowance, because an allowance means, whereas those two people, I'm sure they're decent people who are in the hotel room next door to the adolescent and Tusla are paying €1,200 a night in total, they're entitled to sick pay, they're entitled to holiday pay, they're hopefully entitled, to, well, should be entitled to pensions. Foster parents get none of that. None of that.
No.
And how long have you been fostering?
15 years.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, the reason that I came on wasn't to go down the whole rabbit hole of money and things like that. And we've had that conversation. We'll be having that conversation again. My main issue is it's Fostering Awareness Week.
Mm-hmm.
We are in dire straits when it comes to foster care. And I don't think people, and it's been ignored.
Okay, do you mean in terms of numbers or?
In numbers, yeah. There just aren't foster carers out there. And then when I read these comments last night, you know, I was lying in my bed going through different social media outlets, and there was all these articles, and there's Tusla trying to recruit new foster carers, and underneath, and they have to turn off comments, and, you know, other outlets and news agencies and all those are turning off comments because of the horrible comments that are coming in. And if you see people who could be very good foster carers, and they're reading those comments, it's going to put them off. And if they think that that's the kind of thing that they're coming into, you know, if that's the kind of group that they're joining by becoming a foster carer, and it's just not true. Now, again, because of my empathetic personality, I do understand some of these people are probably people who have had their children taken into care, who, you know, maybe have not had a good care experience themselves, who have read these comments previously and have this constant, you know, wheel of this just hate going on, and they're starting to believe it. So I don't know why they're putting these...
But it's not the foster parents that take the children. There's a whole process, including the courts, often. There's a whole process where children... and this has nothing to do with foster parents.
No.
Where the state decides, through a whole series of process and advice and guidance, that the child... and as we're discovering lately, some of the parents of especially newly arrived young people can't even be found. But in a lot of cases, in every case there is a process. And at the end of that process, not having any parent doctor part in the process is the foster parent.
Yeah.
And you've only one one issue in one priority, and that's the child.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So it's just, it's very unfair, it's unfounded, it's vile, and it just makes us feel really bad. And, like, I know a number of wonderful foster carers who have, you know, these are not people that are falling at the first hurdle. These are people who have been foster carers for a very long time, and they're leaving foster care for whatever reason. And then, but people aren't coming back in, you know, there's... The people aren't being recruited.
Are they not? Are there people leaving, Catherine?
Yes. Yeah, there are. But when I see these comments last night, and, you know, it's just like, are other foster carers reading them? Are they the people that have had a very, very tough day? You know, and we do have tough days. We have very tough days. And are they reading them? And are they just saying, oh, I can't take this anymore? The comments are vile and they're unjustified. And, you know, it upset me enough to contact you. And I know it upsets my fostering friends. You know, they all see them. I was getting texts like, have you seen this? Have you seen that? They're horrible. And if you're having a bad day, and there are many bad days, and they're long days and they're tiring days, and, you know, it's just not what you want to see at the end of it, you know, that you are this person. You know, you may have gone through, you know, dealing with a very, very traumatised child and had a very tough day, and then to read that, oh, you're this villain, you know, totally unjustified comments from people.
But given the week, given the importance, I know foster parents. A lot of people know they're absolutely brilliant. They're a gift to society.
Yeah.
And you do nothing but encourage people if you can to become a foster parent.
Yeah.
Because the alternative, as we've discovered recently, the alternative can be very, very heartbreaking. I know there has to be alternatives at times, given that some adolescents do break down, so to speak, and need different settings. But the alternative, as we've seen in the last few weeks, is really difficult to fathom. The alternative, if we had more foster parents.
Yeah, absolutely. Because the kids are always going to be coming into care. You know, we have unaccompanied young adults coming into care, or children coming into the country. They need some place to go.
Yeah.
You know, that there's always going to be drug addiction. There's always going to be, you know, even something as simple as the medical system here, you know, the hospital system. You know, there's people here, women getting sick who can't take care of their children. You know, there are lots and lots of different reasons why children come into care. But if the foster carers aren't there, where do the children go? They have to go someplace, you know. And there is more residential units opening across the country. There has to be, because there just aren't foster carers there.
And would you, I don't want to put you on the spot, Catherine, but you would encourage people to consider becoming foster parents?
Oh, absolutely. Okay. Without even hesitation. It's the most rewarding thing I've ever done. You know, it's amazing. And, like, you know, I was thinking about it earlier before I came on. I was thinking, you know, that initial call that you get, And even though you know deep down that it's a really, really sad situation,
yeah,
and
yeah.
that this child, but there's that little air of excitement in our house. You know, I have three kids myself, but it's like we're going to meet someone else that we know we're going to love. You know, and we do. And another thing that I just wanted to mention as well, you know, I have an 11-year-old little girl. She's not in care, she's my biological daughter. But when I was reading those comments last night, I was thinking, you know, she's more care aware. You know, she's seen the darkest side of humanity, but she's more care aware than these people who are writing these vile comments. And if she had seen them, which I would shield her from because I wouldn't want her to see them, you know, she wouldn't stand up and say, that's not true. And she's 11.
Yeah. Isn't that an incredible testimony to your daughter and an incredible reflection to the, on these keyboard warriors?
Yeah.
I hope, but the reaction, Catherine, but the reaction we're getting is totally positive to foster parents. They maybe it's the revelations over the last few weeks. It took that for people to realise how blessed we are as a society, how lucky we are as a society. We don't have enough, but as you've explained, some of the reasons that we have foster parents, and we need more. We need more because the gift is just, and the difference you make is just incredible. Just incredible.
And it is so rewarding, and I can't explain. Like, it's hard to put into words how rewarding it is. You know, it's the most beautiful thing. And, you know, people often ask, why do you do it? And it was a long time, and I thought, God, I don't know how I did it or why I do it. But recently we had come to the... almost to a conclusion that we were going to end.
Yeah.
And we almost had.
Yeah.
But when our last little boy left, you know, it's very hard to do long-term for a long time. And we've had a number of long-terms.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
my heart was broken. And I actually just didn't think I could take it anymore. And, you know, and there's guilt. There's a little bit of guilt about bringing someone into the house. And, you know, your children's falling absolutely in love with them. And then them having to leave. And I had a little bit of guilt about that. And putting my children through that again. So we stopped, and I found myself, and like I work part-time, but on my days off, I found myself sitting on my bed and looking out in the garden, mm-hmm. and I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing with my life? You know, what am I doing? I need that. I need to, you know, dote on children. That, like, it's just, it's my life.
Yeah.
And now I know for sure why I do it.
You know, sounds like a vocation almost, Catherine, in a beautiful way.
Yeah,
a lovely way.
It is.
Okay, Catherine, thank you so much for that contribution and the contribution generally you make to society, and you and foster parents. Joe at rte.ie, 51551 text.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
By the way, the company and the producer, director, writer who wrote OC and produced OCD and Me, it was mentioned by Bernadette earlier on, Adrian McCarty from Curious Dog Films. They are saying, if you email us, it's not, unfortunately, it's not in the RT player for various reasons, but... if you email us, joe@rte.ie, simple email, and if you ask us, just ask us for the link. We presume people will be only emailing us with genuine reasons. That's the world we live in, and let's believe people are good like that, which they are. If you would like to see that, OCD and Me, would you email your details to joe@rte.ie, and we will send you a link for that. That very powerful piece, OCD and Me. Frances, back to foster carers. Frances, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe. How are you?
Good. You were listening to Catherine there, and
I do. I was. Just want to say, like, you know, I do emergency care, and Catherine, like, hats off to people that actually do long term care, because they get so emotionally involved. The child is part of every sport, everything they do. And then all of a sudden, then due to court order or whatever it is, you know, they just don't know how long they're going to have the child. Yeah. And then, you know, the children in the family get used to it. But I have to say, I have to take my hats off to them because they are amazing people. Now, I do emergency foster care, and the thing I have to say is there's a lot of misinformation out there about foster carers. I think when somebody sees one bad comment, they go, I didn't like that comment. Mm-hmm. And maybe they might put a comment up or they might like it. But the thing about being a foster carer, and I'm emergency, so I get children in maybe every night. I have two children at the moment. So I get a call maybe at 2 o'clock, the children might arrive at 5 o'clock in the morning. Sometimes the situations wow. are absolutely extreme.
Yeah.
The two kids I have at the moment, complete neglect and actually shocking to see. People don't see that.
Yeah.
But when they come into my house, it's like I do say to them, look, this is your time. This is a holiday for you. This is a break.
Great.
I never,
Great.
There's no overstepping a mark as letting you them think you're the family, you're the mom. None of that happens. And the way we talk to them is, you know, you're going to see your mom, grand. She just needs a little bit of space or blah,
yeah.
blah, blah.
Yeah.
Or you need a bit of space.
Brilliant.
Because you have to let the child think
Brilliant.
That there's still a link there.
Yes.
Obviously. And we're just going to, I mean, the kids I have now, you know, they're out the back there playing. They've everything they want food-wise.
Gross.
Like, I do find some kids go into the fridge and go into the press and they fill their bags because they don't know when the next time they're going to eat. So that's what you're dealing
yeah.
with, you know. You're dealing with extreme abuse, violence in the home, sexual assault, and these are the kids I'm talking about. But, the whole thing about this is it goes back to society,
mm-hmm.
drink and drugs, it's what's happening there, and they need to address addicts. And if they addressed addicts from the doll, we would not have as many children in care. The people, the parents need support. And I can't stress that enough. It's too easy to go down the road of starting to have a few drinks and next of all it becomes your life. And next of all, you know, you can't go through your day without a drink and the
mm-hmm.
children are, you know, suffering. Like, if that's addressed, you know, the need for foster carers won't be as you know, much as it is now. But foster carers do, and I just have to stress it, you know, we are good souls. We go training 4 or 5 times a year. We're up to scale
yeah,
on absolutely
yeah,
everything.
Yeah.
You know, I don't care what the parents have done. Everybody that has children, you know, they deserve their children and they deserve to have a happy family. People go down the wrong road for loads of different reasons and we're all human beings.
Yeah, of course,
and it's just
yeah.
lucky that I didn't. I'm lucky that
yeah,
I didn't
yeah, well
and you're
said,
lucky
yeah.
that you didn't.
Yeah, well said.
You know, so so the whole idea of foster caring is preparing the children for, you know, your next step or, hey, you know, let's go out. We're going to do this and let the children be excited about the time they have away because realistically inside they want that time, but they're afraid to show it in case it shows like they don't care about their parents, you know. But and I don't think people realise, you know, what foster carers do and get in their
mm-hmm.
door. At any one stage, like, you can get a child in that's been completely battered and coming from a hospital.
Because,
and,
yeah.
you know, you're a counsellor, you're a nurse, you're a foster carer, and you're not sleeping
mm.
because you have to keep one eye open or one ear open or whatever. Then you get children in that self-harm. So you're sitting outside the bedroom door, the door open, hoping they're sleeping because you cannot go to bed because every knife, every fork, every bottle of bleach, anything that's in your house, it needs to be protected because that child, you know, can come down your stairs, take anything and self-harm, which has happened to me lots of times. The children can run out the front door.
Yeah, oh God.
So
yeah.
you have a huge... I know
yeah,
I'm going
yeah.
on, but I just
no,
need to
know.
Get all this in because I want people to understand we're here to step in when the parents can't. But we're here as it's, you know, we're here to smooth over the, you know, like it's not that your parents don't want you. It's just that, you know, mom just needs a bit of time or she's doing this or she's doing that. And when the children are in that atmosphere, they realise, you know what, this is okay. We're happy here. And they'll ask questions about their mom or their dad. And they can have the phone whenever they want. But people need to realise there's this old-fashioned thing about, oh, foster carers are only doing for money and this, that and the other. I mean, I get €2.50 an hour to dress, to clothe,
yeah, yeah.
to feed, to heat. And some children haven't had a bath or a shower in months. So the shower is going constantly. And to be honest with you, the more they stay in the shower, the more happier you are because they know they're happy in themselves and obviously they want to clean themselves and whatever. So people don't realise €2.50 an hour and that child gets every single thing and even more. And I was on to you a few weeks ago and I'm the woman that said I sat outside Tesco with two small children. One of them came actually with a Garda jacket wrapped around him because he had no clothes except a nappy on and I literally had to sit outside Tesco's till it opened so I could dress the children. So, like, that's, you know,
yeah.
the dedication that we are. The government do not, I don't care what anyone says, and
mm-hmm.
I'm sorry for going on, I need to get
no,
this
you're
out.
Right, Francis, go on.
What they say is, they say, Ireland is the best place in Europe to be a child, because they say that the help and support is there and the money's there. But the children that need the support are in the foster carers' care. And the money is going from the minister, drip down, mm-hmm. down, until it gets to the likes of us, which are on 250 an hour. Do you get me?
Yeah.
So they're standing in the dole and they're saying, we've done this, we've done that, aren't we amazing? But the people that are dealing with the abused children are the people like us that they'll sweep the floor with, they'll think nothing of, and then they'll hand you 250 without even a pension.
So now keep saying it, Frances, €2.50.
€2.50. And it's not, this is, I'll tell you what this includes. This includes all food, all clothes, because children don't have clothes.
Yeah.
I mean, one of the children I have today, like, came absolutely hair matted together, had lice, body lice. You know, the poor child, yeah. But the government don't realise that. One of the children is wearing nappies and he's six.
God.
You know? So, I mean, like, they're turning around and they're giving you 250 an hour. But you're sitting up with some children all night because the children are self-harming. So you're putting yourself... Yeah, and then one of the cases I had to go for counselling for because it was horrific. But if the minister is listening, we are the people that do the work that you talk about in the Dáil. You talk about what you've done, the words that you've said, but we're actually doing those work, doing that work. It's after filtering down from you, you're getting the highest money, then the next person, then the next person, and when you get to us, there's nothing left. And we're taking in those situations and we're looking at these people. If somebody from the Dáil or one of the, I don't know, one minister wants to get on and dispute this with me, I will dispute down to the ground, because I'm the one and we're the one that have those special needs. Now, it's not every child that just comes in with those needs. Children come in with ADHD, with autism, your windows are broken, your cutlery is smashed. My microwave was taken out of my press the other day and smashed on the floor. The top of my hob was smashed. And these are things I have to pay for myself. So if any minister wants to come and interview me or talk to me or see or take the notes of the damage and the things that I have had to do to mind that child. So if there's anyone listening out there that's willing to take the foster carers and look individually at what we do, and the emergency carers, we don't just take one or two children. We have children every night, and we could have two children. We could have a whole family of children, you know, together at one night at 2 o'clock or 3 o'clock in the morning, who's after going through horrific abuse. And I'd like them to say, hold on a minute now, we're after filtering this money down. It's got to the bottom. We've talked about all these people. We're saying how amazing we are in the Dáil, but these people are actually getting 250 an hour. And these are the children that are in most need. So the children that are in need, again, are with the likes of me on €2.50 an hour.
Yeah.
So there you go. That's
well
my
said,
say.
Well said, Frances. Well, no, it's brilliant and well said. And thank you so much for your such a powerful part you play in society. Such a powerful part. And above all, in the lives of those children who find themselves in difficulties not of their own making. Good to meet them all, good Frances. Joe at RT.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
I'm Joe at RT.ie. Back to this decision. Well, it's been around for a while, but now it's in crisis. The decision the rule by Bus Éireann that once a driver hits his or her 70th birthday, it's bye-bye to driving school buses. Pat Phelan. Pat, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Joe.
How long were you driving the school bus for?
I was 13 years, Joe, from 2008 to 2021.
And why? You were let go. You were stopped driving school buses. Why?
I reached a big age of 70 in August of 2021. And I finished up in the last week of June when the school's finished. But I was 70 in August. So that was it. I was surplus to requirements then, and I couldn't carry on anymore. And
there was no give, no leeway, no medical, no.
No. No, nil whatsoever.
You couldn't go in and say, I don't know whether you did, or I had a medical only recently and I'm flying fit, I've passed everything in terms of being a driver.
I had a medical every year from the year I started, from 2013. Okay. And I have asthma, right? Not in a big way around that, but I have it. I'm on an inhaler. Excuse me. And I was sent to Dublin every year. I live in Kilkenny. And I was sent to Dublin every July, August to have this medical in Marlborough Street in the headquarters of the Busairn Medical Centre. And I was put with my paces there for around 30 to 40 minutes, like, you know, where you were, you had your ECG and you were the treadmill and all that kind of stuff. And you were always tested for drugs and drinking and everything else, like, you know, alcohol, if you want to call it that. So we went through the mill and it's fine, no problem. I passed it every year and I said, sure, this is great now. I'll be, and I get to 70, sure, my head tissues are great and there's no problem. But
you see, as we said yesterday, the CEO of Busairn quoted two studies. One from, he didn't give the exact detail, he hadn't got them to hand, which is understandable. One Canadian and one Finnish, which supported his argument. He said that 70 had to be the one fits all decision. Once you hit 70, you're gone off the school bus, to speak. The Canadian report I came across did not endorse that wholeheartedly by any stretch of the imagination. I can't find a Finnish report, though I did find last night a Norwegian report. And the Norwegian report is, there's one very stunning graph, and a relative risk of involvement in injury accidents by driver age and gender. Okay? And it goes from 16 to 19 up to 75 plus. Okay?
Yes.
The 65 to 74 age group have almost, and it's quite low actually, have almost the exact same number of accidents, which is quite low, as the 25 to 34 age group, according to this extensive Norwegian survey. But remember, you can start driving a Dublin bus. You can start driving a Dublin bus, a Busairn bus, when you're 21.
That's
even have to be 25. So 21-year-olds have a worse, and I use that word, a small W-O-R-S-E, a worse driving record than 75-year-old plus. And yet it's the 70-year-olds who have as good a driving record as those between 25 and 34, which is lower than 20 to 24, by the way, lower than 20 to 24. The 70-year-olds plus 70 to 75 have a similar record to the 25 to 30, 35, which is among the lowest, obviously. And they're the ones that have been told, get out, get off the bus, back after this break. joe@rt.ie.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Danny Tiernan and Roscommon, you say you drive you're 70, you can't drive a school bus, but you're driving other buses with children.
Yeah, I drive what's called the Rossi bus from time to time with young kids going to football matches and that.
And what do you think of the Busairn rule, 70 and you're off the bus?
It's crazy. Absolutely crazy. They're predicting what's wrong with you or what's going to happen, or, you know, it could happen to a 21-year-old, 25-year-old. Those surveys that they did, I would like to know how many of the age group were actually responsible for the accident.
Exactly. And as I say, I quoted this graph there from the Norwegian study, which said that 75-year-olds had the same accident rate as 25 to 35-year-olds, which is among the lowest. And they had a lower accident rate, 75-year-olds, than 21-year-olds. But if you're 21-year-old, you can apply to be a driver of Busairn. And if you're 70, you're off the bus. I've got to go. But by the way, the study that was mentioned 5 days ago on Dry Time, we've eventually got the name of the study that Busairn are relying on, so maybe people can look it up. A Canadian paper looking at ageing school bus drivers was published in 2012 at the 22nd Canadian Multidisciplinary Road Safety Conference. More to follow. Sean O'Gorman, producer Ray Darcy, next.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Elevate your bedroom with our fresh new bedding designs and colours, in store and online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815 stays open until 3:15 p.m. or email joe@rte.ie.